You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of August 2017 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Lamentablemente, los españoles conocemos muy bien.
Regretfully, Spaniards are familiar with the absurd and irrational pain that terrorism causes. We know terrorism can be defeated by institutional unity, by police cooperation, by prevention, by international support, and by the firm determination to defend the values of our civilization.
Spain's Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy speaks after yesterday's terror attacks in Barcelona. My guests Andrew Tuck, Henry Rees Sheridan, Carlota Rebello, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including, very arguably, Donald Trump's weirdest week yet, music streaming platforms, dating sites, and other entities doing what the president wouldn't, and unequivocally jettisoning neo-Nazis, and which statue would you like your country to pull down? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests for the first part of the show, at the very least, are Andrew Tuck, Carlota Rebello, and in a late unannounced addition to our bill, Editor-in-Chief Tyler Brulé. Welcome all. Within the last hour, Finnish authorities have confirmed that two people have been killed and at least eight injured in a stabbing attack in Turku. Police have made one arrest and said further suspects are being sought, but have not yet declared whether they are regarding it as a terrorist incident. It follows yesterday's attack in Barcelona, in which 13 people were killed and dozens injured by a van ploughing down Las Ramblas, and a subsequent vehicle attack in nearby Cambrils, in which one person was killed and after which police shot dead five suspected jihadists. Islamic State claimed responsibility for the attacks. Tyler, first of all, are we focusing on the media coverage of these? There has now been so many of these attacks, rather sadly, that a pattern is beginning to emerge in terms of response. But are we actually learning anything about how to cover attacks like this? Is the media getting better at them?
I'm not sure if the media is getting better at them, because I think one of the big problems, if you were watching, you know, anything from Sky News this morning to the French networks to CNN, etc., is there is a pattern of language, and it all sort of falls into the sort of rhythmic pace that after, you know, the first hour, we hear sort of hearts and prayers, and we've got the first responses, of course, from leaders around the world. You know, then, of course, little by little, various tidbits start to emerge with regard to the investigation, and then suddenly the language of a fast-moving and fluid case. There's all of this. It becomes very, very scripted in so many ways, especially, and we know it's very difficult doing live reporting at that speed. Many networks, of course, with limited resources, maybe not the number of producers and researchers that they once had. So I'm not sure if the level of coverage is any better. At the same time, you know, and this is the problem with contemporary broadcasting. You know, we've moved away, Andrew, from a world of the 5, 6, 7 minute mini documentary. Where is the reporting and the great investigation in between? If we're supposed to be asking the right questions, if we're supposed to be delivering potentially responsible answers, or at least being thought-provoking to a viewing public, I don't think there's that level of journalism being done in between. Maybe the funds are just being deployed to say we can make sure that we get our satellite dishes and our people there on the ground right away, but where's the analysis in the middle?
Andrew, the other angle, well, one of the other angles to this is, of course, the urbanism one. We have actually done quite a lot of stories in the magazine recently about how cities can inoculate themselves to an extent against attacks like this. And Las Ramblas, obviously, a major urban target, a huge tourist attraction in a great world city. Are any countermeasures that a city can take about a potential target like Las Ramblas, are they going to be always essentially symbolic?
I think it makes people feel a little bit safer if they have some sense of, you know, bollards and restrictions and that traffic can't enter key spaces. But on the whole, what happens is that these are methods of deflection. They move an issue somewhere else. And in a large city like Barcelona, if the driver couldn't have gone up Las Ramblas, he could have gone and hit the queue waiting to go into the cathedral at Sagrada Familia. He could have gone on to any other site. He could have gone down to the beach and mown down people at the beach. I don't think that the police or the authorities should be blamed for there not being enough bollards to stop one van getting in. Yes, they can try, but there's not a simple urbanism solution. This is terrorists, and terrorists who use more and more banal methods to deliver their terror, and you can't always stop that.
I think it was the New York Times that put it as postcard terrorism. I don't think it's a coincidence, the fact that all the eighth past terrorist attacks we've seen with vehicles have all hit pedestrian streets. And it's about tackling that way of life and what that represents. And of course, putting up barriers gives a kind of false sense of security to the people in a city. But I wonder what it does long term, if it means you no longer can enjoy that space that you've reclaimed as public space for you the same way you did before, because an event forced you to change the way you interact with the city you live in.
Yeah, certainly the London Bridge attack, when we saw that, you know, weirdly, if it had been the old days, you know, the 70s or something, with traffic lined along the bridge parked at night, then nobody could have mounted the curb. It's because we have made it like bowling alleys wherever you go that it is much easier for a vehicle to get onto a very wide pavement that's as wide as a road often and plow down it. And that is a difficulty of like pedestrianization. It comes with this weird cost, and it's the same as stripping out, you know, curbs and things, making surfaces flat, this notion of shared space. Again, it makes you very, very vulnerable.
Tyler, does it look like that this is what we have to brace ourselves for the foreseeable future, that the jihadist movement, to the extent that it's that coherent an entity, appears to have abandoned its sort of grandiose obsession with airports and aeroplanes, which are extremely difficult targets to strike at, and has realised that basically you can generate more or less the same amount of terror, press and attention by doing something as low-tech as hiring a van?
And for the last year now, you know, and maybe if we rewind a year, you know, we heard lots of experts saying, well, the war is really going to be coming to, you know, a street near you. And maybe this was, you know, already the sense, okay, we're days numbered for Raqqa, and obviously fighters returning. And it sounded a little bit hysterical, but I think, you know, that is very much the case. And I think what you've heard more of, and I think we've touched on this, you know, quite a few times around these microphones, that, you know, this is also, it's a generational issue. It doesn't matter what happens. You are not going to be able to eradicate the problem of jihadism as it exists in many European cities in a short span of time. So unfortunately, I think that is something that we are going to have to wrestle with, you know, unless you see a roundup and a heavy-handedness, which, of course, you know, I don't think anyone would be looking to tolerate. But that's probably one of the only things you are going to be able to do to say, are we going to be able to compress this from a generation to 5 or 6 years? But I think that's very unlikely.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at the United States, where even by the formidable standards established by Donald Trump's presidency thus far, it has been quite a week. His failure to clearly, comprehensively, unequivocally and unmistakably condemn a neo-Nazi rally which resulted in someone's death has prompted what feels like a substantial shift in a crucial section of his support. America's business community, which has now deserted his advisory councils and issued statements denouncing, if not Trump personally, then certainly the sentiments he failed to censure. Andrew, we will come to that shortly, but some breaking news just as we go to air is that at the end, well, nearly the end, it's only lunchtime in Washington, of this eventful week, Steve Bannon appears to be out.
Yes, and it seems that he's saying that he resigned a full 14 days ago and agreed to kind of stay on until now. And particularly, I guess, because of the events in Charlottesville, he may have thought that his voice was needed to back up, in some sense, Donald Trump. Now, this is a man who I don't think many people in the world of politics or certainly journalism are going to miss. But it's interesting because he has been seen as a chief architect of the tone and the delivery of Donald Trump's whole campaign, his demeanor in office. So without him, you know, will anything change? We don't know. Donald Trump seems to be saying that he didn't want Bannon around anymore. And it must have been a very difficult time, because ever since they've got into power, there's obviously been a bit of a tension between Donald Trump's, you know, free willingness around policy and Steve Bannon. For you might not like his policy, but he has a certainly direct view of what he believes should happen.
Tyler, it does add to a perception of the wheels coming off the Trump bandwagon. If, I mean, his support remained doggedly loyal. A poll this week said that 61% of Trump supporters said literally nothing he could possibly imaginably do would change their minds. But not so much about the Bannon thing. How damaged is Trump, whose whole pitch was that I am a great businessman, I am a deal maker? The fact that actual businessmen and deal makers are now dumping him and deciding they don't want to be associated with him, does that damage him?
It does, but you know, and I think this is probably one of the most significant things. You know, aside from all of the outrageous things that he said, all of the theatrics that we've seen, you know, the revolving door that has obviously kept, if he even has anyone looking after HR, clearly not, incredibly busy. You have to remember, this is America. This is about entrepreneurship. This is, you know, a nation built on people, you know, pulling themselves up, launching their own businesses, having their own success stories. And when you see, you know, obviously very learned CEOs, but also those CEOs who've worked their way, you know, up through the corporate ranks, deserting him, I think that this is actually, especially when we get to the weekend and all of this gets dissected and people really have time to listen and it's going to be thrashed, you know, in and out and around 1,000 times, I think this will start to hit those people that you're talking about as well, saying, if we've seen this type of desertion from all of the various councils that he's established and formed, I think that starts to hit hard. The only problem, though, is that, nevertheless, the U.S. economy is still doing incredibly well.
Carlotta, the other thing among the other desertions that struck me this week, well, they weren't really desertions, they weren't quite repudiations of Trump by name, but it was unmistakable what their target and their motive was. We saw those statements by both President George Bush's decrying racism, bigotry, etc., etc. But more significantly, or at least as significantly, I thought, was the statements by the actual four-star heads of America's armed forces, from the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard. Again, obviously not mentioning the Commander-in-Chief by name, but, you know, with unmistakable timing, you know, separating themselves from the sentiments that he'd espoused, which is, it's getting very close to insubordination.
Well, the fact that you have all the top generals immediately after Charlottesville and the remarks from the president, not mentioning him by name, but saying that the army does not tolerate that sort of language, that sort of behavior. And I also found it interesting the fact that, you know, a CEO that wasn't in the council, Tim Cook from Apple, issued a memo to his staff saying that because of that, and because that's not in line with his beliefs and what he believes this company should stand for, he's donating $1 million, making $2 million donations to two organizations that work to prevent hate speech. And that leads to a broader question about why is hate speech allowed in America? Because, yes, it's protected by the First Amendment, but when it gets to a point that you're asking for violence and crossing the line to people's civil liberties, should it be allowed?
I mean, I think also I was going to say, but maybe Tim Cook, you know, just, I mean, it's great that he's giving money, but he could also maybe drive around to some of the other campuses near him and speak to some of his contemporaries at some of the social media companies as well would also be quite useful. And I think having, you know, and it's great that he's doing that, but having someone who's truly vocal, regarded the world's most valuable company, saying it and doing it, and I think also galvanizing, I think, some of the biggest offenders as well would also be useful.
Well, on the subject of donations, Carlotta, you referred to those ones from Apple there. James Murdoch, of all people, has decided to donate $1 million to the Anti-Defamation League. There's been certain mumblings of rebellion by some presenters on Fox News, Andrew, but from a magazine point of view, we've seen this week some extraordinary front pages from American news journals, Economist, New York Times, and Time in particular, explicitly linking a sitting president of the United States with the iconography of the Klan. It's pretty extraordinary.
Well, the president did it himself. I don't think they had to kind of push that idea very hard. I think that they've come out more and more in recent weeks to say what everyone thinks, you know, that this is a president that seems slightly detached from all of the things that you hope a president would do. You know, a certain demeanour, a politeness, a way of bringing people into the fold. There's a very good piece today in one of the key American commentators saying that he's pushed himself so far from the mainstream and taken people down a path that they just can't follow him anymore. So whether that's the business leaders defecting, whether that's the generals defecting, he increasingly finds himself in a rather isolated position politically, because even the Republicans who have core votes who backed him, they're going to find it very difficult to follow him much further along this very erratic route.
Well, the trouble he has there is that polls still continue to show his support at around 79% to 80% among registered Republicans. Tyler, does that suggest that the Republican Party might have a bigger problem than Donald Trump?
Well, that also goes back to, I think, you know, haven't we sort of learned from polls as well, and you know, and I always sort of, I'm a little bit sort of skeptical about, you know, the core audience that you might be going out to talk to, and you know, are they sort of, you know, really just, oh, here's another thing, I'm just going to sort of, you know, is it on default? It's a little bit like magazine subscriptions. You know, I keep on getting my subscription to The Economist. I love The Economist, by the way. But I'm never going to sort of tick that box to say I don't want it. And hopefully, you know, it's the same thing with our readers. We're actually introducing auto-renewal as well. You've been warned here first. But is it the same thing also, if I'm a card-carrying member of the Republican Party, is it also just a bit of a default? It's sort of, I auto-renew my president.
But that's what makes it quite, it's difficult to rank what of the many things that Trump does is the worst. But the damage done to American diplomacy, like any of these front pages, these covers, would be enough in any other administration to start seriously considering getting rid of this president and wondering if he should be sitting in the Oval Office or not. And the fact that those numbers still hold up, the fact that you still have people within the Republican Party that refuse to condemn this, even after Charlottesville, even after everything, it's staggering. And it makes you wonder what happens after Trump. Whoever comes after him, will America ever be able to restore in a short term the sort of status it had before in terms of world affairs?
Andrew, we just heard an interesting point. We had lunch with a rather prominent airline CEO here at Midori House this afternoon, and so it was interesting when you look at U.S. travel patterns right now. He's not from a U.S. carrier, but just said the amount of outbound U.S. traffic. I thought that was one of the most interesting things. The amount of people flying out of the United States. And it does raise an interesting
question. Desperately clinging onto wheels and engines.
Are they looking for greener pastures? Are they looking just for a bit of relief? Who knows? But I thought there was something very telling in that.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, currently joined by Andrew Tuck, Tyler Brulé, and Carlotta Ribello. More shortly.
Are you looking to strike a better work-life balance? If so, then the shiny new September issue of Monocle magazine is just what the doctor ordered. Join Monocle's business team as they head for the most agreeable third-tier cities. Moving advice for those on the hunt for a new live-work base. Breathe in, breathe out, and discover why third-tier definitely doesn't mean third-class. Step into the office of some select founders and CEOs to see exactly how they go about their work, from illustrator Christoph Niemann to legendary designer Dries Van Noten. And there's more. Hear from the first female Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, illuminating views on Geneva's neon scene, a walk through the transformative architecture of Jakarta, and savour the sight of Sweden's garden restaurants brought to delicious life on the page. That's all in the September issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now, or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me is Carlotta Ribello, but Andrew and Tyler have tapped out, and Henry Rhys Sheridan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco have tapped in. Now, last week's events in Charlottesville, Virginia, were a depressing spectacle by any measure, evocative of an America that most Americans would have preferred to believe their country had evolved beyond. The days since have provided some cause for optimism. We've seen the extraordinary dignity of Susan Breaux, the mother of murdered anti-racist protester Heather Pompeo. The widespread reinforcement of the key line of the Declaration of Independence from pretty much all sources but the actual White House, and a far-reaching and often quite witty backlash against members of the Tiki Torch-toting Legions of the Night. Fernando, first of all, one of the marchers, Chris Cantwell, who I think has probably been the funniest of them so far, he was the one who inexplicably posted a video of himself blubbing on YouTube at the thought that he might be in some sort of trouble. He's also been banned from Facebook and from OkCupid.
As a former member of OkCupid, I think it's an excellent idea.
do we agree with this? Should people basically just be heaved off social media platforms because their views are objectionable?
Yes, and you know why? No, and you know what? I'll give you an explanation. Even I think a libertarian type would agree with me. We live in a free world. Those are private companies. I think they can decide who is going to be a member or not.
This is always what I have thought. I'll start that sentence again. The argument that social media companies often make is that they're entirely neutral conduits of information, like a telephone line or something. But it strikes me that they're more like, they're like a bar or a pub. They're where people go to gather. And if somebody came into your bar spouting racist nonsense and waving a tiki torch and a swastika and making unpleasant remarks about various people, you'd throw them out. That's not infringing their freedom of speech, Henry. It's just saying you can go outside and yell at the traffic, but you can't do it in here.
That's a really interesting set of analogies to apply to the kind of digital communicative sphere. When you think about how they actually operate in terms of the relations between people, I do think that we're dealing with a sphere which is pretty unprecedented, because I think there are elements of actually both those models in there. You know, on the one hand, it's undeniable that, you know, some of the dynamics of a bar, some of the less favourable dynamics of a bar, in fact, are replicated on there. But at the same time, to hold the owners of these companies to account by the same standards as you would hold the owner of a bar to account, there are probably some issues on which you would be tripped up there. So I would be careful to draw that analogy too closely, but it's certainly an interesting, it provides interesting food for thought.
When you describe the idea as interesting, do you mean that in the English sense, by which you mean it's the most idiotic thing you've ever heard in your life, or do you actually think it's interesting?
No, I was using it in the... I'm not sure what other country uses interesting in the genuine term, but I was using it genuinely.
And one of the things that Henry said, you know, it is difficult for the owners of those social media, you know, platforms to control, because, you know, I haven't seen the profile at OkCupid of that particular guy, but
hope he kept his swastika out of the photo. But that said, for some people, but
that's what a surprise. In other words,
and as a former user of those types of platform, you do get a lot of hate messages around there, you know. So it's funny. I even saw a TV show recently. People were kind of quite racist, very openly on those sites. They say, please, if you're black or if you're fat, don't message me. So instead of saying the type they want, they say what they don't want. So in some ways, those platforms they already.
Carlotta, this may be something of a self-answering question, but are we surprised that when the spotlight is turned on them quite a lot of these terrifically brave white supremacists we saw parading and chanting in Charlottesville turn out to be a bunch of sobbing, self-pitying, whining crybabies?
I'm sure you want me to answer that.
I think it's a rhetorical question, yeah. Andrew.
I think you gave the answer pretty much there. But it's not the first time we've seen this. We need to remember during the campaign, awareness was raised towards the fact that these websites, you know, you would have ads that are provided by Google, so the companies don't directly say, I want to advertise on this website or the other. And people were telling others, these CEOs saying, hey, your company is being advertised in the Daily Stormer, for example, pull the ad out, because it would you didn't want the brands to be associated with this movement. And I find this mini tech revolution quite interesting. I mean, we're talking about Google, GoDaddy and Cloudflare, all platforms that host websites that stopped hosting the Daily Stormer. Even WordPress, a blogging platform, shut down the blog of one of the guys that was in that same march and was filmed by the Vice News documentary. PayPal stopped authorizing so payments for Ku Klux Klan merchandising. All the fact that all these small companies, all these companies are taking these small steps, I think in the end will add up. And even Airbnb banning people from staying in Charlottesville if it looked like they were going to the protest. If that's your core belief as a CEO and what you think your company should stand for, in a sense, you wouldn't employ someone like that and you wouldn't want that to become a reflection of the community you're trying to foster. The same thing with these social networks, I think go for it.
Okay, well, finally tonight, President Donald Trump did find time this week to tweet his support of statues, which he described as beautiful, of senior figures in the Confederate States of America, which is to say the ringleaders of a treasonous revolt against the country he now leads. Various jurisdictions around the U.S. have begged to differ. In Baltimore, four rebel monuments have been removed in the last few days. More look set to follow them into museums. Now, there are four of us around this table from four different countries. I count Brazil, Portugal, Wales / the United Kingdom and Australia. So starting with you, Fernando, are there any statues in Brazil that for whatever reason, whether aesthetic, historical or just rank personal prejudice, you would quite happy see the wrecking ball taken to?
There are actually, and I'm from São Paulo. There's something called Bandeirantes, which is they were 17th century Portuguese settlers. I mean, they were fortune hunters. They discovered a lot of cities in Brazil. So they had their rolling society, but they also enslaved quite a few of the indigenous population. Sometimes they even kill them. But when you go to São Paulo, most of our monuments are from Bandeirantes. And I find it shocking that, okay, we do have some, the Zumbi, which is a famous slave leader as well, but why they're not more preeminent? Why we have someone that killed so many people as well in a horrible way? So it does affect me every time I go to São Paulo and you see those huge statues of the Bandeirantes. So yeah, I'll turn it down. Or at least, you know, explain to the people who exactly those people were.
It is a weird one because Australia's history in some respects is similar in that it was built on land that was conquered from indigenous peoples, and I can well see that, although Australia doesn't go much in for epic, you know, heroic statuary, but I can well see that perhaps indigenous Australians might see statues of James Cook and Arthur Phillip slightly differently. Mm. Carlotta in Portugal.
Well, Portugal, after the dictatorship fell in 74, almost everything related to it was taken down. The bridge that still stands in Lisbon was renamed from Salazar's Bridge to 25th of April Bridge, and all statues, name of squares, was all changed. So when you asked me to pick a statue and you kept that very vague, it could be anything related to anything, I decided to pick one that... it's quite new, but I'm ready for it to be gone. So, as some listeners might know, I'm from Madeira Island, and it's that lovely statue of Cristiano Ronaldo at the airport that looks nothing like him.
So ugly.
Even though
listeners should Google it.
Just Google Cristiano Ronaldo statue. You will not be disappointed.
No, you really won't. I think probably anybody who's been on the internet in the last 6 months has seen it. It's extraordinary,
and it plays a really nice role when you land in Madeira. If you're there for the first time, the queue of people just to take a picture with this awful, awful statue. But one of my favorite stories is about Mozambique's public library, which at the time was Portuguese colony. They had a statue of Salazar, our dictator, and afterwards what they decided to do with it was to turn it against a wall in a corner as if his, you know, penance for what he has done. And I think that's a great way to maybe use some of your awful heritage.
Henry, which statue would you like to see expunged either from the streets of Wales or the wider United Kingdom?
You gave us the option of employing aesthetic, historical or rank personal prejudice for selecting the statue. I'd like to avail myself of the first and third of those options.
Good.
As
okay,
is my want.
Two boxes ticked.
So there's this...
you've bought a picture.
Horrible statue. What a prop.
Excellent.
You're familiar with the poet Dylan Thomas. He's from Swansea, where I'm from. They have, the powers that be have taken it upon themselves to erect, at some point, I don't know, in the history of Swansea, this hideous, hideous statue of him, looking extraordinarily restless and a bit melted in a chair outside a theatre that bears his name. I've also got a close-up of his face so you can see that his eyes are voids. And listeners can also see that too if they want to Google it. So an unpleasant statue of an unpleasant man, to be frank.
Well, as I said, Australia doesn't go much in for heroic statuary as a people, but I am sure that either outside or both either or both Victoria Park or Glenferrie Oval in Melbourne, there's a statue of somebody who used to play for Collingwood or Hawthorn. Either of those, all of them, any of them would do me fine. That does bring us to the end of today's show. Thanks to all our guests, Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck, Henry Rhys Sheridan, Carlotta Ribello and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Isabel Rosen. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next, Marcus Hippy with The Menu at 1900, The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday, 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Miller. Have a great weekend.